Does it matter? Does it matter whether everyone benefits from the state or whether everyone benefits from the property rights system? Does it matter when we put these institutions in place without asking everyone if they want to live under these institutions? Does it matter if putting it into place actually benefits everyone, or whether it harms some to benefit others? Many philosophers do not give a straight answer to this question. They have a hard time giving a straight answer to this question. There are others who are a little more clear, and one of the arguments that I make in this book, in this presentation, is that the correct answer is that it does matter. It does matter, and people have been too ready to assume that either it doesn't matter or it matters, but it's obviously true anyway. And it's the equivocation of going back and forth between these two points has caused great problems for social contract theory and property rights theory ever since. Well, according to Thomas Paine, it not only matters, but it is the first principle of civilization. He says, the first principle of civilization ought to have been, and ought still to be, that the condition of every person born into the world after civilization commences ought not to be worse than if he had been born before that period. And Thomas Paine isn't the only one that can give a straight answer. Robert Nozick says, compensation would be due for those persons, if any, for whom the process of civilization is a net loss. And Rex Martin says that a single common underlying idea of economic justice can be found in Locke, in Adam Smith, in Marx, and in much recent contractarian theory. The arrangement of economic institutions requires, if it is to be just, that all contributors benefit, or at least that none are to be left worse off. Gautier calls it the great theme of moral and political thinkers in the development era of capitalist society, this sort of idea. And Gautier, I think very helpfully, recognizes that there is a moral principle which he calls the Lockean proviso, that plays a part in two very different theories, or two otherwise very different theories, contractarian theories of the state and propertarian, for lack of a better word, justifications of the property rights system. Both of these justify the imposition of an institution, but they do it in very different ways. Contractarianism justifies the state based on the idea that we should have a state. If we all want a state, we all want a state because a state makes us better off. Whereas propertarian theory argues that people have a natural right to property. It doesn't flow from an agreement, but they have a natural right to establish property if and only if doing so doesn't harm the propertyless. So both of them involve this claim that if you want to create this institution, it should be one that doesn't harm it, that doesn't harm anyone. However, Nozick goes very quickly from saying that it matters to saying that it's obviously true anyway. He says, I believe the free operation of the market system will not actually run afoul of the Lockean proviso. Here I make an empirical historical claim, as does someone who disagrees with this. And that's as far as he goes into actually providing evidence for this empirical historical claim, just making sure people know if they want to disagree with him, they also are making an empirical historical claim. But that hardly provides any evidence of it. Now, I'm having some problem seeing my notes here. And Kafka says that, there we go, okay. Kafka says the need for a social agreement simply reflects the Hobbesian fact about the human condition, that the state and a high risk of insecurity and poverty are exhaustive alternatives. So he's saying it's a fact, it's a Hobbesian fact, that there are two exhaustive alternatives. Either you have a state or you have this very high risk of insecurity, which is gonna make pretty much everyone worse off except for crazy lovers of violence. Unless you're a lover of violence, the state is going to make you better off. It's a Hobbesian fact. Well, it's not a fact, it's a hypothesis. A fact that has not been historically verified is a hypothesis. So what I'm talking about here is the recognition that in both contract theory and natural property rights theory, there is this moral principle, which is that everyone needs to benefit from the institution if it is going to be just. That's the moral claim. Then there is the factual, empirical claim that, in fact, everyone does, in some sense, benefit from this claim. So at least no one is harmed. And this book argues that this empirical claim has been asserted without empirical proof or really very much evidence for hundreds of years, at least since Thomas Hobbes, in some senses, far longer. It's sloppily presented that there's no clear definition of exactly what empirical facts have to be in place for this to be true. And there's a lot of equivocation. Is the hypothesis is needed to justify existing institutions, and it's obviously true, or the hypothesis is really not needed after all. And there's sort of equivocation of going back and forth between these two. And this allows a lot of sloppy analysis that gets people, that frees people using these theories to get away with things they really shouldn't be getting away with. They credit, very often you will see them making claims crediting these institutions with making us better off. Oh, now of course the state benefits everybody. Of course the property rights system benefits everybody. But then, if you say, well, what is your proof that these institutions benefit everyone? And then they seem to rest on this other interpretation where it's not really a factual claim, and they deny the need to provide evidence that it's been fulfilled. So they admitting then that the theory is partly applied by implying that it is a pure theory that has no empirical component. Clarity, and this clarity of presentation, are we making an empirical claim that we believe is obviously true, or are we proposing a pure theory that doesn't require any political claims? This sloppiness in presentation is as much as what the book is about as my claim that they do use this empirical claim and that it is false. All of that is important. And I think this power of this unnamed premise, this Hobbesian fact, which is really a Hobbesian proviso, a Hobbesian hypothesis that supposedly we're all better off, this equivocation about it, this fact that people have not really paid attention, that this Hobbesian hypothesis has been around and assumed true for 350 years, has helped let people get away with this equivocation. Now, what is this hypothesis for? I think one of Hobbes's early followers, or at least someone who agreed with him on this point, said it best of exactly what it's for, way back in 1672. He says, "The complaint of the masses could be met in no better way than by picturing in their eyes the state of nature." So they're saying, you claim about inequality, injustice, and poverty, but they say, shut up with your complaints. The state and or the property rights system is in your interest, because if it wasn't for them, you'd be these naked savages like these people that we're colonizing around the world. You'd be just like them if it wasn't for these institutions. Now, my claim is that is a destructive myth. It authorizes poor treatment of both. It authorizes poor treatment of disadvantaged people in our society because it makes us think, oh, we benefited them already. They're better off So we could treat them better, but after all, these institutions are in their interest because they're not these naked savages whose life is nasty, brutish, and short. But it simultaneously justifies colonization of indigenous peoples to say, you're so bad off that we can take over your areas against your will and force you into our property rights system and our state system, because after all, you will be better off. We haven't said any evidence that you're better off, but everybody says so, so it must be true. And this idea, this destructive myth, has gotten so pervasive that often it's conceded by people who don't want the masses to shut up. People have often resorted to saying, well, we need a stronger proviso, that the Lockean proviso is not strong enough. We need a higher standard. And even though you can say the lowliest person in a capitalist state society is better off than a person in the state of nature, we need a higher one so the masses don't have to shut up. And they haven't thought about, well, is it really true? Have we even achieved that much for everyone? And there's a rare few that have been skeptical. Throughout history, there have been many, but one of the best examples is Thomas Paine, who wrote in the 1790s, "The life of an Indian is a continual holiday compared to the poor of Europe, an abject poverty when compared to the rich." But yet, we find a lack of evidence, interest in evidence. Even Thomas Paine, who said that he had some contact with Native peoples, but he didn't write a treatise on exactly how Native peoples live, with him bringing in empirical evidence and comparing that to how the lowliest laborers in capitalist society live. He sort of asked you to take his word for it the same way that Locke and Hobbes did. And you find this trend of people just asserting this and not asserting evidence, not seeing really any interest in evidence from people on either side. There are some exceptions to that as well, but I will get to that. Now, this lack of interest, I think, is symptomatic. What myself and Grant McCall argue in the book is this. Philosophers and social scientists still routinely discuss prehistory as if it were the stuff of myth, passing on centuries-old stories that change little or not at all as empirical research uncovers evidence. Many philosophers pass on stories set in prehistory without clarifying whether they illustrate important empirical premises or whether they are pure metaphor. They seldom clarify what those premises might be or what the metaphor might stand for. And so the argument we make here is that the Hobbesian hypothesis is an empirical claim. It's an empirical claim about prehistory. It appears in all plausible justifications of existing states or existing property rights institutions. It is presented in a sloppy way. Little or no evidence have been provided by supporters of this hypothesis for the last 350 years, and that this hypothesis is false. The poorest and least advantaged people in the world today are quite often worse off than they could be living in a stateless society based on anthropological evidence. Implications then at the end, we talk about the implications for the justifications of the state and the property rights system. So the approach is like this. The book has five chapters to show that political theorists really do make this claim, to pin them down, going from Hobbes to the present day, that some state it explicitly and or use it in their conclusions, stating conclusions in a way that don't make sense if it's not an empirical fact. Then we have three chapters to examine anthropological evidence that compares the least advantaged people in our societies today and a typical person in a state, in the stateless societies that most lack state in private property institutions. And then one chapter to explore the implications of that idea. And when I say this is a destructive myth, I think there's something important in a destructive myth that is missed out. A good myth is one that it doesn't matter if it's true, if what is stated is true. It matters that the underlying thing that is going to get to is true. Like, take the Adam and Eve story. The Adam and Eve story, you can take that to say, is that all human beings are born to innocence. We are all children when we begin. And when we are children, we are not capable of knowing right from wrong. But eventually, as we get older, we cannot fit into this area of pure innocence. And we begin to understand right and wrong. And we all inevitably, at some time, will choose to do wrong at some times in our lives. And for this, we need moral improvement and moral guidance. I think in that sense, the Adam and Eve story is a very good myth that really says something very real about the human condition. Well, there are two other ways you can look. Well, maybe at least, I'm sure there's hundreds of ways you can look at the Adam and Eve story. But one way you can look at it is it's all Eve's fault. Adam was doing fine, then he listened to Eve. She gave him the apple, and his only, you know, she knew it was wrong. She convinced him that that wasn't really the apple from the tree. If only he hadn't trusted Eve, everything would be fine. And so the greater truth here is that men have to make all the decisions. Now, if, and I have heard interpretations of the Adam and Eve theory put that way. And if that, now, that theory is as good as it is true. If it is really true that women lack moral judgment, then that's a good myth. It demonstrates something that is very clear. Now, but I happen to think that is false. I happen to think there's overwhelming evidence that that interpretation is false. And it makes it a destructive myth by those who will use it to justify sexism. And another way you could interpret the Adam and Eve story destructive is to interpret literally. Literally, it doesn't really make sense. Snakes alive today that can't understand history are being punished for something this one snake did back then. And men and women alive today that didn't know Adam and Eve are being punished for their sins. It's a very strange one if you take it as a literally true story. But then it really matters if it's literally true. So let's get on. Now, what I'm saying here, well, what Grant McCall and I are saying here in this book is different than the most common criticisms of property rights theory and of contractarian theory. And so people very often want to pigeonhole us into other criticisms of these theories that they're more familiar with. So I want to head off some of those. One is that we're writing here to say something about the fact-value distinction. I actually believe there is a fact-value distinction that it is possible to do pure philosophical, ethical theory that has no reference to any facts whatsoever. That is not our contention. Our contention is that to use you could justify the Lockean proviso as a moral principle using just moral premises to say this is a moral principle, that I think you could do in pure value theory with no reference to facts. But the argument here is that Lockean-based and Hobbesian-based justifications of the property rights system and or the state are not pure theory. They are applied theory. Whenever you go to trying to justify the existing property rights system or the existing state based on saying that it fulfills this principle, you then need an empirical claim that it does, as a matter of historical fact, fulfill that principle. So really, what we're saying here has nothing to do with the fact-value distinction. Others want to say that we're rejecting the moral premises of these theories. Actually, quite the opposite. We are applying the moral premise of these theories to the facts of the world as we are able to determine them by empirical research, which most of the people writing on these topics have not bothered to do. And what we find researching these theories is that what they actually imply is the state and the property rights system are not yet justified. That they can, they have a good chance of being justified, but to justify them, we're going to have to treat the poor and the disadvantaged people of our societies better than we've been treating them so far. Others want to say that we're getting involved in this historical method versus a priori method of theorizing. I think there's a good place for historical reasoning and a good place for a priori reasoning. They're both very valuable. What we are opposed to is people that are actually doing historical reasoning and kind of sneaking little historical premises into their a priori reasoning without checking those. That is what we accuse both Hobbes and Locke of doing, and many of people who've used similar theories. And others will think that we're talking about the origin of the state or the origin of the property rights system. Hobbes, and this is an unfair criticism that people have made, especially of Hobbes, for really ever since he started, that he's saying, oh, we actually began the state when we were in a state of nature and we all came to an agreement. It's because our ancestors made this agreement, we're bound. Hobbes does not say that. He makes it very clear that the agreement is something that each of us makes, because each of us knows in our heart that if it weren't for the apparatus of the state keeping the peace, we would be at the throats of our fellow humans. And so that we all, since we know this about our personalities, we know we need the state, and we all consent. Now, other people have done it in different ways, but it is not about the origin of the state. It's about the pairwise comparison of the state to a stateless society, the state of nature, the unfortunate name for society without a state. Also, we get a lot of people saying, well, if you really understood this theory. Well, we've been through a lot of theories. We've been through a lot of people from Hobbes to the present day, and I'm getting to the point where I think if there's some version that we haven't come to, it's going to have to be a pretty obscure version that we haven't looked at. So others will say that we're defending Rousseau. Now, actually, Rousseau doesn't figure very much in this book. We do look at Rousseau a bit, but Rousseau is really asking a different question. Rousseau is asking, what is the nature of humanity? What is people's basic nature? Is it peaceful and corrupted by the state, or is it corrupt and it is civilized by the state? He and Hobbes do have this disagreement, but that disagreement is only one contributing argument for why people might be bad off in state societies. It is not, I think, a very important one. It's not one that people take terribly serious today, and it's not something we are interested in. Other people will want to accuse us of romanticizing the noble savage. This noble savage idea was applied to Rousseau, but actually Rousseau never used the term noble savage. It hadn't been used apparently for about 100 years before Rousseau, and didn't get used again until about 50 years after when Charles Dickens, of all people, resurrected it. But shortly after Dickens, an early anthropologist named John Crawford decided that the state of anthropology in the 1850s just wasn't racist enough. Is that people just had too much sympathy for native peoples. And so what he did is he accused everybody who said something even slightly sympathetic towards native peoples as romanticizing the naked, the noble savage. Is that you're putting them above us and you're wanting to hearken us back to an early golden age when everything was wonderful before it was corrupted by our modern institutions. And this has worked in this way ever since, even though few, if any of us, are as overtly racist as Crawford and his followers were in the 1850s. You still hear this term, noble savage, and you will still hear it applied to anyone that says that indigenous peoples have something they can teach us. It comes up a lot. And it is an oxymoron. And it's an oxymoron that it's made to be an oxymoron. It is made to be, how could you be noble if you're a savage? A noble is a person who has the highest trimmings of civilization. And a savage is someone who lacks all of those. It's clearly made to be a noble savage. You cannot be both noble and savage. And it is made to put a pall over things when people say, people say, if you say one good thing about indigenous peoples, then you're saying indigenous peoples are better than us in every way, and you're just romanticizing them as being these perfect naturalistic beings. We are not talking about them as perfect naturalistic beings. We are talking about indigenous peoples as peoples like us. People who are living in different circumstances and in different ways and have done different things to attempt to solve their problems. What can we learn from them? Can we learn whether this hypothesis that's been going around for 350 years is actually true? And really, it's only indigenous peoples who get this noble savage allegation compared to them. Imagine if I said that Sweden has a good welfare system, that I like Sweden's welfare system and Norway's welfare system, and I think we could learn one or two things from them. Now, I'm not saying they're perfect people. I just think we could learn from the Swedes and Norwegians on a welfare system. Imagine if I had to deal with people saying, you're romanticizing the polite Viking. Suppose I said something good about Scotland, and people says, you're romanticizing the generous Scotsman. Or if I said something, or the sober Irishman. If you had to deal with it, if you had every time you wrote about the Norwegian welfare system, you had to head off the allegation that you were romanticizing the polite Viking, and you thought that all Nordic peoples were just better than we are, that would put a pall over what you're trying to do. It's worked that way very well for that, just those reasons. Now, I think in Hobbes's version of the social contract theory, it's very well known. The state is like a contract. It has to be justified in mutual advantage. It cannot be parasitic. The inherent need for the state in Hobbes is clear. He says, out of civil societies, there's always war of everyone against everyone. Not sometimes, not always, not just during the English Civil War. He spends a lot of time talking about the English Civil War. But his argument rests on it being an inherent psychological problem that people cannot live without an authority to settle disputes. All but the rare few who love violence are going to be... All but the rare lover of violence is going to be better off in the state rather than in statelessness. That is connected to another hypothesis that we find in here, and that is the violence hypothesis. Hobbes's justification for the state was the state making us better off, is that stateless societies are inherently above some threshold of intolerable violence. That violence in those societies is intolerable. It might not be non-existent in our society, but it is so much less that we have so much better reason to feel safer that we are better off. And to the extent that Hobbes argued that we were poor in the state of nature, for him, it was flowing from this violence. Because it is so violent, then we cannot have industries, and because we can't have industries, we are poor. And of course, his reasons, his psychological argument that it is not just sometimes violent, but stateless societies are always violent, comes from his famous psychological argument where he talks about competition, diffidence, and glory. Or you could call them gain, fear, and reputation. We attack each other because we want to gain from attacking each other. We attack each other because we fear others will attack us. And we attack others for reputation as becoming a bad dude that nobody will get that. So with the violence hypothesis put together with how difficult it is to do anything under such violence, he comes to the final quote where he says, the life of man is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And he even goes for empirical, he goes into empirical confirmation of that. He says, he looks at the at civil wars is one confirmation, but he also says the savage peoples of many places of America have no government at all and live at this day in that brutish manner. So he clearly recognizes this is an empirical premise and this is empirical evidence that it is true. So he's saying, our society is like a contract. It has saved you from this, and you should not worry about it. Now, there are many people who've looked into Hobbesian theory who agree with me, at least insofar that it needs an empirical claim. Ian Hampshire Monk, C.B. McPherson, John Lucas, Richard Tuck, from the Cambridge version of Hobbes's Leviathan, and David Gautier all explicitly say that it requires an empirical premise, and I can get you quotes if you want. George Klosko, Gregory Kafka, Russell Hardin, Kinch Hoekstra, Gene Hampton, Rex Martin all say that it relies on some sort of empirical claim. Now, and there are alternative interpretations of Hobbes. One that is, all he's doing is giving prudential advice. And that, I think, is a very legitimate interpretation of Hobbes. That he's saying, look, you want a state because it's going to make you safer and wealthier. I'm not saying everybody wants a state, but any wise person does. Any person, unless you love violence and poverty, you're going to want to live under a state. And that's my advice. So my advice to you is obey the state. I think that's a legit interpretation. The thing is, that has nothing to do with what we're saying here, because that requires the same Hobbesian hypothesis that the state actually is better off, that it really makes you better off. Another version is the random baby version. You say, well, you take a random baby and the random baby is going to be better off in the state. So even if some people are worse off ex post, you could say if you had to choose between being born into a state and being born into a stateless society, you would choose the state, despite systemic disadvantages that might hurt otherwise. The random baby version does not work for several reasons. One is that we're not random babies, that we are born into specific circumstances. And some people are born into circumstances where they're very likely to get the benefits of the state and the property rights system. And other people are born into circumstances where they are very unlikely to get those benefits. And so those who are born into those circumstances from birth or from early in their life have very good reason not to accept this random baby version. Another problem with the random baby version is that it concedes one of the things, it gives up one of the things that is supposed to be this great advantages of social contract theory and any theory with a proviso, is that we are not a parasitic society. We are not a society that benefits some at the expense of others in any systematic way. We are a society that benefits everyone. We're not like utilitarianism, where if for some reason it benefits us to torture you, we're going to go ahead and torture you. The proviso is supposed to rule that out. If you go to this random baby version, then you're giving up the reason that's supposed to, or one of the key reasons, that's supposed to make people choose a proviso theory against a theory that has no proviso. Now, another version of Hobbes that I think clearly is wrong and doesn't work is the belief that it's purely for illustration, that there is no truth in the possibility of a state of nature, or that it is bad. It is just a purely theoretical alternative. If that is what he meant, then really it's just not a very good theory. It's not good at justificating what it wants to do. So that I compare to, say, the giant chicken hypothesis of state justification. Right? I admit that that Hobbesian theory is more plausible than the giant chicken one. And the giant chicken is that the hypothesis is that there's a giant chicken that lives on Mars, and it loves states. And if we don't have a state society, the giant chicken is going to come over here and swallow the Earth whole. Well, if that's true, we better have a state society. I won't get eaten by a giant chicken. But if it's false, I don't see what relevance that could possibly have. The greater plausibility of Hobbesianism is the plausibility of the empirical argument that actually things will go wrong if we go to the state of nature. Now, there's another one like that, which is the Civil War proviso. It's not really about how indigenous people in non-state societies live, that it is about civil war. Right now, if society fell apart at this second, then we would all be much worse off than indigenous people, because we have billions of people, we're dependent on our property rights system, on a big trading system, all of which will fall apart, we'd be at each other's throats, many people would die before we got back to any sort of an indigenous style situation. That may be true, but that cannot be the justification of a state that makes some people systematically worse off than people in non-state societies, because it creates a conflict of interest that's not supposed to exist in contractarian theory. The as Gene Hampton says, a theory like that is rigged in favor of the state. The state makes us dependent on it and then uses that dependence as a justification for it, as justification for the state. But what Hobbes argues, and the reason he goes into that argument about psychology, is that we have an inherent need for a state which exists in everyone, everywhere. Even if there had been no state, we have a reason to create it. If we didn't need a state to begin with, and in fact it was going to make a few people worse off, then those of us who are harmed by the state have an interest in gradually getting rid of it. Not getting rid of it all of a sudden, but gradually getting our population down to the point where a different sort of lifestyle again becomes popular. It's in their interest to do that, and it is in other people's interest not to do that. So we lose this idea of the state as a truly mutually beneficial association with this little amount that has to be together. Now, the Hobbesian hypothesis also exists in property rights theory in a very different way. John Locke justifies rights against the state, while Hobbes is justifying rights of the state. And they use it in a very different way. It's not so much contract-based, it's natural rights-based, but this side constraint on the establishment of this natural right is that you don't harm anyone. And that not harm brings in this same mutual advantage proviso, which we use in the same way Gautier does, is saying that it has to be mutual advantage. And then it virtually, Lockeans and Hobbesians make the same empirical comparison. They are comparing the least well-off people in state capitalist societies to indigenous peoples in non-state societies that have a common property rights regime, the absence of private property. And Locke makes the very same empirical claim. Americans have not 1/100th the part of the conveniences we enjoy. And a king of a large and fruitful territory there feeds, lodges, and is clad worse than a day laborer in England. So this great property rights system has made these day laborers so much better off than these indigenous peoples. For him, it's not so much violence. He thinks that you can defend yourself decently in the state of nature. He doesn't need this violence hypothesis. It is instead a hypothesis about poverty, that people really are poorer in indigenous societies than they are now. But yet, he provides little or no evidence that this is true. He makes that statement, but he's taking that statement from colonial accounts of people who are conquering territory from these indigenous people, are saying, yeah, they're naked, they're savages. We try to take their We try to establish property rights, make them day laborers so they can be better off, and they don't like us. These are nutty, weird people. I don't know. So there is a lot of self-serving talk going around at this time, which seems plausible to Europeans, because Europeans are so much more powerful than the indigenous peoples that they're conquering around the world. So they look, well, why are we so much more powerful? Do we have better genes? Maybe it's a racist explanation. Or maybe we have better institutions. That was one thing about Hobbes and Locke that was maybe superior to some other people at the time. Is they didn't say so much that we have better genes, that we're a better race of people, but we have better institutions, which might be true, but the question is whether it in fact is true. Now, then since then, we go through several chapters looking at people who said similar things through the following years, and I can get you quotes from all of these people. You can go back to the first emperor of China, who said something very much like the Hobbesian hypothesis in 222 BCE. Hobbes, Pufendorf, Locke, I've all mentioned. Hume, even though he's a critic of contractarian theory, says very much the same thing. Adam Smith takes Locke's thing about the day laborers being 100 times better off, and he multiplies it by 10. The day laborers are 1,000 times better off. Burke, Kant, people with very, very, Burke, Kant, and Hegel, very different theories. Very, very different theories, but all with some use of this Hobbesian hypothesis. Bastiat, the early right libertarian philosopher, Leslie Stephen, 1904. Will Durant, around 1942. William Golding, The Lord of the Flies, where he has these English school kids who are taken separated from their authority figure, and then they become exactly like the most cartoonish depictions of savage natives that you can imagine. And an introduction to The Lord of the Flies, the version I read, said he wanted to write a book how people would really behave in these circumstances. So he's certainly saying really behave. Eric Voglin, C.B. McPherson, John Lucas, Robert Nozick, James Buchanan, Murray Rothbard, John Zestberg, David Gautier, Gene Hampton, Gregory Kafka, Lauren Lomasky, all different versions of this hypothesis. Jan Narveson, Ian Hampshire Monk, Eric Mack, Richard Epstein, Christopher Heath Wellman, writing in Ethics in 2001. Interesting thing about Christopher Heath Wellman is that he actually has empirical verification. And his empirical verification is as follows. He says, the advantage of political society are so great because life in the state of nature is so horrible. And in support, he says, Hobbes, Locke, and Kant offered conflicting accounts of human nature, but all agreed that stateless environment is a perilous environment devoid of security. So that's his evidence. Those three long-dead philosophers who knew less anthropology than he did, and he probably does, all thought it was true. But that's really about as good as people get of actually trying to back up this hypothesis with fact. And George Colosco, Tibor Machen, Dudley Knowles, Fred D'Agostino, John Thash, and Gerald Gauss, and at a conference last year, Jean-Fabien Spitz said something to this effect. So I've even got some of us saying it. Now, I should say that there are a lot of people who are bystanders in this argument. The most people who think that people should be treated, that the poor should be treated better, have not attacked this hypothesis the way Thomas Paine did. Most of them have been like Dworkin, Otsuka, Rawls, Scanlon, Steiner, Van Parijs, and many others to say that even if this hypothesis is true, the Lockean proviso is too low. We need a stronger Lockean proviso. We've got to treat people a lot better than people can live in a stateless society with a common property rights regime. And that might be morally true, that we need to treat people better. I'm sympathetic to the idea that we need a stronger proviso. But by taking this tack, the bystanders actually feed this perception that we actually know this is true. How do we know this is true when all these people have been repeating it and not providing evidence? That's one thing. Something that is repeated and repeated gains authority from the repetition. We think so many people have said it, somebody must have verified it. But it's really the other way around. So many people have said it that nobody's felt the need to really verify it. The one that came closest was Bastiat, who was like calculating what you can buy with a day laborer's salary and how you would build that, rather than looking at how well off people are. Let's see. Now, there have been skeptics. There have been skeptics such as Lord Shaftesbury, Montesquieu, I mentioned Paine, Henry David Thoreau, Herbert Spencer, Henry George, Marx and Engels, Henry Sumner Maine, John Robert Seeley, Peter Kropotkin, Henry Sidgwick, and I got quotes from anybody you doubt. More recently, Carol Pateman, Alan Ryan, Charles Mills, Alistair McIntyre, Thomas Poga, and Peter Lindsay. I was a little embarrassed about Thomas Poga because one of the last thing I did when I was finishing my book was add in like a whole page saying positive stuff about what he says on this issue. And then I sent it off to the publisher, and then this scandal broke. It turns out that he's been sexually harassing people for years. And I was like, Oh, well. Still, what he said there was correct. Now, the book does three chapters of evidence. I think I'm going to skip most of the evidence for now in interest of time. If you want to ask me anything about it in the question and answer session, you certainly can. I'll be glad to talk about it. But I'm going to go to the implications of this, partly because some of the implications will deal with likely objections that people are going to have. The verdict. Okay, Kim Hill. One thing about the evidence. Kim Hill is one of the anthropologists who is least enthusiastic about life among Native peoples. He's the one who has said that these claims that they hardly work at all are not true, or that they have few hardships, or they have to live a life of abundance. These claims are not true. But I, in personal correspondence, I asked him this question. And this is a man who lived with the Aceh before they gave up their traditional lifestyle, while they're still nomadic hunter-gatherers. He says, modern societies are plagued by emotional, physical, and mental problems that probably weren't very common in the past. Hunter-gatherers seem to have less depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, suicide, feelings of alienation, etc. There are no campus massacres in hunter-gatherer ethnographic literature, for example. All of these observations and many more suggest that the advances of modern society have also come with costs. There were no homeless or unemployed hunter-gatherers, and probably fewer that endured forms of blatant exploitation and slavery. So I think that comes down to saying that the benefits have only reached the average person, this we talk about in the book, the benefits have only reached the average person sometime between the 1800s and the 2000s, at the time that Hobbes, Locke, and Smith were writing. You could not even say that the average person in Britain was better off than a person in a stateless society. Now you can almost certainly say that the average is, but still the bottom is too low. And that's, I think, what is said. We've really picked a low bar. I'm not saying people in stateless societies live well. They actually have a short life expectancy and they have a difficult life. But the tragedy is that we've picked such a low bar, but then by telling ourselves that we've jumped over it, that we actually give our, and without even looking to see if we've succeeded, that we failed to surpass this bar. And having this destructive myth that tells us you are better off than these stateless peoples, and I don't even have to show any evidence. You know that it's obvious that this destructive myth is making it easier for you to fail to surpass this bar. So we write in the book, the poor, the discontented, that it's unfulfilled for the poor, the discontented, the political dissenters, the homeless of developed countries, the billions who live on less than $2 or $3 per day and who do so much labor for the rest of us, the billions who die young of cancer and other modern diseases that did not exist in stateless societies, and complications of pollution and bad diet, the millions of people with lead poisoning, the billions who lack adequate food or safe drinking water, millions of families who need support from child labor, the victims and perpetrators of campus massacres, and the urban foragers who must find food in other people's garbage. These are the people for whom the hypothesis is not fulfilled and the proviso is not satisfied. Now, we talk about the implications for this theory. The implications are, if the state of nature isn't that, above all, what they need to do, what social contract theorists, especially social contract theorists, need to do about clarity, I think that the property rights theorists have been more explicit that this is an empirical claim. They haven't been good about providing evidence, but at least they've been clear that it's an empirical claim. Now, many social contract theorists have not been so clear. They need to get out of this equivocation where they credit these institutions for benefiting us all and then deny any need to provide evidence. They've got to say, if the state of nature isn't real statelessness, what is it and why is that relevant? When the only reason I can't live in a stateless society is because states block me from living in a stateless society. If it would make me better off, why am I not allowed to try? Is there a protective argument to the state when the violence hypothesis is false? And the violence hypothesis is false. Poverty, you go a little better. Sorry, I didn't have time to do much of the evidence. Poverty, the idea that these societies are poor is much better than that they are violent. Is there a protective argument for the state when the violence hypothesis is false? Is the argument for the state inherent, that all people everywhere are better off with the state, or is it a contingent argument where now that we're dependent on the state, now that our population is so high, then we have a state? There's nothing in this contractarian thing, well, we didn't used to need a state in the past, now we do, and we surpassed that point in 1542 or whatever year it might have been that we surpassed this. And if it matters whether the proviso is fulfilled, then the question becomes, what happens when it's unfulfilled? So that, I argue, for clarity. Another one is that they have four possible responses. I think one is reject our empirical findings, and we welcome this challenge. This is the only challenge to what we're saying here that preserves contractarian theory in full. The idea that there is an inherent need for a state, that even stateless people should desire a state if they know what's good for them. You can only keep that idea in full if you're willing to reject our empirical findings, and I welcome it. And one thing I say, if you're going to reject our empirical findings, be at least as thorough as we've been in finding them. Okay, I didn't show you that, but it's in the book. It's three chapters, and I've been talking for a long time anyway. Now, another one is open only to property rights theorists, not to contractarian theorists. And that is what I call the general Fuhl response, which is to accept our findings and blame the state. Say, oh, actually, if it wasn't for the state, a properly functioning private property rights system would not violate the proviso. If only the state was different or wasn't there and we had anarcho-capitalism, whatever it is, then it wouldn't be a problem. It's the state's fault. It's really the property rights system that these right libertarians are all about anyway. And I call this a general Fuhl response because General Fuhl was a real person who was fictionalized not Trotsky, not Tchaikovsky, the other one with a T, who wrote War and Peace.
Tolstoy.
Okay, the Russian with a T. Okay, I should get that. Tolstoy, in General Fool was a German general who was on the Russian side during the invasion. And he had this plan that he said was going to defeat Napoleon. And everybody else was afraid of Napoleon. All the other generals were afraid. He wasn't afraid because he had confidence in his plan. But his plan, he never doubted his plan, and as often as it failed. Because every time it failed, there was always somebody, it was such a detailed plan, that there was always somebody who didn't fulfill the plan. And somebody that didn't, that's why it failed, because this person didn't do this thing that made it work. So no matter how badly his own plan failed, it worked. And there, here we have in the world today, we have much greater poverty in the United States than we do in more socialist countries like Norway and Sweden. Yet they will say, well, but that's really because we don't have the right. Actually, in some ways, Norway's actually more libertarian than we are. And there's so many different versions of libertarianism that no matter what goes wrong, you can always blame one of those versions. So I'm not too sympathetic to that response. It should be generally, if you get closer to the market, people should get better off. And that's not what the trend is. Another is you could try to say that what we're saying is irrelevant. Just try to bracket our findings to say, okay, these indigenous peoples might be better off and the worst off here, but that's not relevant. One way is this ex ante versus ex post, this random baby argument that I talked about, which I can concede that for some issues, like an ambulance. If you never get sick and then you get run over by a speeding ambulance, okay, ambulances have made you worse off. But ambulances take everybody to the hospital. You know that it's in your antecedent interest to have ambulances, even though you know the risk. I don't think a person run over by an ambulance has a claim against the proviso. But I do think someone who has systematic disadvantage, who is, say, three times more likely to be shot by a police officer than a white person, they have a claim like this. And that's why a random baby cannot work. Now, and I think Rawls gets this right. I'm not a Rawlsian, but in his whole book, I've not been able to find one bad thing to say about Rawls, except for that he's one of those bystanders that feeds his perception. But his actual theory is, he argues that if equal opportunity exists, no one can complain about being the least advantaged group, but they can complain that the least advantaged group is too low. And that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that, I'm saying that the least advantaged group is worse off than they can reasonably expect to be in a stateless society, and we could fix that, but we don't. The extraordinary unlucky need to be extraordinary in their luck. It is not enough that they are extraordinary in their exposures to dangers to create advantages for others. Imposed risks have to be both necessary and equally applied, and this we have fallen on both counts. If society is going to be anything like a contract, there has to be a greater secure minimum. Another is the Lodovico de Colombe response, which is that okay, in observed state societies, things might be worse off. But maybe there's these unobserved stateless societies, like us, our government's disappearing right now. Maybe that would be worse off. Well, there's a bunch of problems with it. This is from Ludovico delle Colombe. I don't know how to pronounce Italian. But he was the guy who responded to Galileo by saying, okay, there's craters on the moon that you can see, but maybe the moon is encased in all celestial bodies were supposed to be perfect spheres. I don't know why anyone ever thought that. When you don't even need a telescope to see the moon's blotchy. I don't get that. But that was a belief that there were only perfect spheres. And Galileo's like, look, you can look at it and you can see there's these craters. And Colombe says, well, okay, there's craters you can see, but maybe there's an invisible sphere that you can't see around the moon, and that's a perfect sphere. Well, maybe there is, but You're no longer using evidence-based reasoning. What you're doing is premise shopping. It's really, you're saying, what is an empirical premise that I can't, that, no, that neither can I prove, nor can anyone disprove? And then I'll rest my claims on this premise that can't be proven either way, and this will justify the horrible duties that I'm putting the lower class under. Well, if you're gonna put people under onerous duties, you need to provide the evidence. If you want to say people are better off, show me some evidence that you're actually making them better off. Don't just give me an excuse why you don't need to show evidence. So finally, and another problem with this is that Colombe response is an enormous retreat for Hobbesian. It gives up the idea that there's an inherent need for the state and says that there's now a contingent need for the state that only exists in the current world. And it also gets you some strange ideas that actually that ancient Mesopotamia, back when should have been subject to a higher proviso than our wealthy societies are today, because back then we could have gone back to hunter-gathering, and now we can't. So we have a lower proviso. It also gives up everything that Hobbes and others were saying about competition, diffidence, and glory. It's just an enormous clumb down for them. So I think the last idea is acceptance, the best way for social contract theorists and property rights here is to admit that we haven't quite yet fulfilled the proviso, and we should. What we have today is a parasitic society, and there's a solution. There's an easy solution. There's a way out. Treat the disadvantaged better. So we're actually sure that they are well off. And that really, I think, is the point of the argument. As Carol Pateman says, the history of consent theory of the last three centuries largely consists in attempts by theorists to suppress the radical and subversive implications of their own arguments. So a well-done version of these arguments would actually say that we haven't done enough, that we need to do more. Okay, I talked for a long time.